Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today my guest is Tommy Orange. I want to say, yes, he's a national phenomenon. His very first book, There, There, which is published by the very astute people at Alfred A. Knopf, landed immediately on the bestseller list, but that's not what interests me. He is a Native American writer of mixed ancestry, but that's not what interests me. What interests me is that I think that he is a real writer, an honest-to-goodness writer worth reading, concerned with things that writers are concerned with. These things include time and space and dream and the intersection of unknowable, unknown characters in places that you wouldn't expect them to meet. That is to say, the book There, There is a landscape that ostensibly takes place in Oakland, but it begins with the notion of contradiction. Gertrude Stein, who was born in Oakland, said there is no there there. And here, the title of this book tells us, there there. This is my home, and there's a there there. As much as I may love Gertrude Stein, I come from somewhere. It's Oakland, and Oakland can have a literature as well. Were you concerned, when you're growing up in a place like Oakland and wanting to be a writer, were you concerned that the place was without a literature?
You know, I didn't think of myself as a writer growing up. I came to it late. Once I became interested in writing about Oakland or thinking about Oakland from a writerly perspective, I was puzzled by the fact that nobody had written about it. You know, Jack London, Gertrude Stein, and they didn't even particularly write about it. They just sort of mentioned it, maybe.
They negated in a certain strange way.
So it was bizarre to me because Oakland is so full of complexity and history. I didn't understand why, and there was this void that it was both a challenge and sort of a thrill to fill. Because, nobody had done it, so I could sort of do what I wanted, but I also didn't have anything to compare it to or to, you know, when I get into writing something, I try to look for as many books that are doing it as possible. It's part of my research process. And there was nothing. It was very strange. I mean, Ishmael Reed wrote a nonfiction book about Oakland. That's
which
really
one?
It's called A Walk in Oakland or A Blues Walk in Oakland or something.
I like him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good book.
Yeah. I'm particularly fond of his novel Mumbo Jumbo. Mm. One of the things I love about my guest, Tommy Orange, is he gave an interview with his editor at The New Yorker, Deborah Triesman. And, you know, if you look these things up, they're not published in the magazine, but you can find them online. And at the end, there was a list. And aside from the people that he would obviously care about, like Sherman Alexie or Louise Erdrich, both of them writers I admire, there was a list of writers that I'm truly crazy about, some of whom have become major international sensations, but some of them are barely still known. These include Clarice Lispector, Roberto Bolaño, Alvaro Mutis, who's the author of a thrilling, it really is, an adventure novel, The Adventures and Misadventures of Mackerel. Felisberto Hernandez, anyone who doesn't know the piano stories is suffering From deprivation, yes?
That's true. I try to, you know, I think everyone should read it, but I try to recommend it to people who I really know will love it.
And the last one, another writer, I believe Russian, mm-hmm. Andrei Platonov. Mm-hmm. And when I saw this, I said, oh, they, by which I mean regular people, are going to try and arm wrestle him into being a Native American writer. And yes, he's a Native American writer, but he's a writer first. And a writer who admires writing that has gone by many names, avant-garde, experimental. A lot of people tend to think that this is the most difficult writing, but a writer named Gilbert Sorrentino said, no, it's the writing that's most pleasurable and fun. And that's what I found was true of There, There. After a sort of stentorian introduction that tells us what has happened in terms of the theft of land and soil of the Native American people, we meet 12 people for whom this theft happened so long ago, it's a given. How are these Native Americans and conjugates going to find their way in a place where there are no jobs, no money, no resurrection, no salvation? What's going to happen? Well, a novel is going to happen to them. Tell me about why these 12.
Well, there were more. There was probably, over the 6 years of writing it, there's probably like 3 books worth of material and a lot of backstories that never found their way to the final. So the first year of writing it, I was almost daily, I was writing a new character or I was just sort of seeing what stuck. I was waking up super early in the morning. I was working a full-time job. I was a new father and I was staying up late to write. I had the idea and I knew it was just sort of a container and I had to figure out what would fit in it and how would the machinery work. And that all depended on which characters stuck and which characters had a voice that felt effortless. The way they finally found their way over the 6 years was, I'm kind of an instinctual writer and it's just a feeling that these are, you know, there's just a feeling that you get when they feel real enough.
The very first character of the 12 who appear, Tony Loneman, he is the inheritor of fetal alcohol syndrome. And once on the monkey bars, a kid says, how come your face is that way? And he's never noticed that his face is any particular way. And this is a book where 12 characters will come together, but not happily. You know, by the last chapter in this book, I will not give anything away, but these characters are not good to one another. They are destroying each other's best wishes. And many of them end up dead. This isn't the way novels end nowadays. Novels more often have happy endings than movies do. And so you really took a risk. What led you to write a novel that would scatter your characters this dramatically?
Well, the idea actually came in a single moment. And when it came, I knew it was going to end in tragedy at the Oakland Coliseum. I didn't know how it was going to come together and how they were all going to connect. And that comes from how I feel about life. I mean, it's sort of like a dark comedy and a tragedy. So I didn't want to just like write something horrific and that did not end well. But the way things have gone and the way things seem to be going is not a happy picture, so it doesn't feel true to me to try to write something that has a nice bow in the end. Or it was always going to end that way, whether from the first second I thought of it. I just didn't know how I would pull it off.
How to get there.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Tommy Orange, the author of They're There. It's a nice surprise because we're hearing about people we don't hear about in fiction. By this, I don't just mean Native Americans. I mean people who've spent their whole lives learning to be a nurse and then got fired from the nursing job and having to figure out how to raise a whole family, because these are not families, by and large, where a mother is with her children. This is the new community. This is the community of people who have to rediscover one another. Those who aren't being saved by other relatives are joining together to sell drugs or commit thefts. But everyone has to find a way to live because there's no choice. We're here, we're stuck till whatever ends us, and somehow or other, we're going to get something to eat by the end of the day, fair means or foul.
Yeah, I mean, I worked in the Oakland community for many years, and this is just often the case. I think the generation, there's a generation that was hit hard by the effects of history and couldn't, you know, there was never going to be some happy nuclear family story. The way things happened, and I could, just being in the community and knowing families and seeing how things went, it was a consistent thing where the conventional family structure was not there, and for reasons that seemed clear to me, but not a lot of people can understand the way history works over time.
Once you point out that these are urban Indians and that they don't have their own books yet. You've written one of the first books. And for urban drifters of all kinds, there are things in this book that I've never seen in a book before. This is the first book I've read where those guns that are made of plastic and manufactured by 3D printers. But this is the first time I've seen these guns in a novel and handled by young people who are taking the guns to a community powwow. In other words, these are Native American young people who are ready to rob their own people. Now, I love Louise Erdrich's fiction, and not all of it is pleasant, but there always is something of a pastoral, exotic, kind of beautifully inventive feel. What you're doing seems to be in the armpit of the imagination.
As in, like, it's a little more seedy.
Seedy, not impoverished, uncertain of what the right thing would be.
Yeah.
These aren't people who are choosing to act wrong. These are people who don't seem to know how to act right. They haven't been given that option. That's a luxury.
Mm-hmm. I think so much of fiction is filled with, like, upper middle class narratives. And how often have I read, you know, somebody who's a janitor or, you know, somebody who wants to find belonging and sort of finds it in, you know, criminal activity. It's something that I know from where I grew up and different things that I experienced. And why doesn't it belong in literature? Why hasn't it been in literature? And I don't know that I have the answer, but I certainly know that it does belong.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Tommy Orange about his book, There, There. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tommy Orange about his book, There, There, a study, a story of 12 urban Indians whose lives converge at the Big Oakland Powwow. Now, I say the Big Oakland Powwow, but that's a construct, right? There isn't a Big Oakland.
There isn't. There's been various different small ones throughout the Bay Area over time, and I've been on a committee that put one together. Nothing on the scale of what I made up. There are the big ones in stadiums at different parts of the country that I was, you know, basing it on. It's not a complete fabrication, but there's nothing like that in Oakland.
Well, you mentioned a janitor and that he belongs in fiction. I got a letter, and I'm hoping the person who read it is listening. I got a letter from a listener who said, Michael, I'm a janitor. I dropped out of high school. I didn't go to college. I never liked English class. But I've been listening to your show, and once, I'm not sure why, I picked up one of the books you were talking about, and in the process I made friends with the guy who owns the used bookstore in my town. We read these books together now. I never would have dreamt it was possible, but I am a reader because of your show. And so, you know, getting a letter like that, or you putting characters who wouldn't normally be in fiction into your book, these are, I know it's sappy, these are acts of salvation. And that's our job here on Earth, to help others have the things that allowed us to stay alive. For me, that was reading. That was books.
Yeah, and I don't know what it was that didn't click with me. Reading, you know, I wasn't a good student, and, you know, the sort of regular, or the what teachers would say is, like, he's not applying himself or whatever. I read certain books along the way, and I never caught whatever it is when you realize how meaningful reading, and particularly fiction, for me. For whatever reason, it didn't happen for me until, you know, I was 24, maybe about 24 years old, when I was working at the used bookstore. And there was a single moment where the novel, particularly, something in me just clicked, and I realized, like, oh, this is what noveling is. And it was about 100 pages into Confederacy of Dunces. I was on a break from the used bookstore, and I was eating a donut and reading Ignatius, and it's sort of a perfect combination of events. And that was the moment. There was another moment with Sylvia Plath in The Bell Jar, and she was doing something with the image of the bell jar, and it was just the most profound thing to me, and I just didn't know you could do. I mean, that's the thing about reading and fiction, and people who don't know they love it. You can do something with consciousness and with thinking, and I think, you know, writing a novel is another way of thinking, like a better way of thinking. I think DeLillo said that somewhere. Just something wakes up in you that you didn't know was possible, and that's what I love about reading and how it explores consciousness and how much it can do. In some ways, we'll never be able to really express what it's doing.
The first novel that made me want to read novels was Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. Why? Because I was sick and tired of people talking sense to me. I wanted to hear nonsense. I mean, later on, we got Talking Heads and Stopped Making Sense, but I needed them, the adults around me, to stop making so much sense all the time. Life was already painful. It's more painful when you're a child. If you're lucky, you grow out of some of that pain. Some people who don't grow out of it become writers.
I think that's an accurate description.
I think it is. And I guess, you know, I'm always, in some sense, looking for books like yours, like They're There, that have buried in them a hidden set of instructions or structures. The characters here they all have something to teach one another, but they rarely meet one another. So you, the reader, are learning what the characters have to teach each other, even if they can never tell each other. And that struck me as being, whether that's the way you would put it or not, it struck me as being a brilliant device, because, you know, most of the time we don't get to teach anyone anything. But sometimes the reader can be the beneficiary of all sorts of instruction.
I think, you know, some people will say, like, who's your audience, or do you think of the reader when you write? And often, you know, people will say, like, no, you stick to your artistic vision. But for me, at some point in my development as a writer, I came to this, it probably sounds basic, but this idea that that you have to keep the reader in mind. And this became very important to me, that I was wanting to meet the reader at a halfway point, and that reading as an experience is a sort of communion with another mind. And to communicate things as clearly and as well as possible became one of the most important aspects to the way I was writing.
At a certain point, I'm curious, you become a student at the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And that must be one of the moments of deciding to keep the audience in mind, that there are people you're talking to who need you. And I wonder how you felt about your time there.
I loved my experience there. And, you know, in wanting to publish the book, I mainly wanted to get a teaching job there. I loved it so much. And that ended up happening, plus a lot more, obviously. But my main goal was to just get a teaching job, because I like teaching and I like the community there. It was around that time that I was thinking of the reader and thinking of audience. Probably the first half of writing the book was just, you know, in a vacuum, pretty much. And the second half was in a community. So it was at that point, the turning point.
For a long time, people were at me to read Jewish fiction. And I was afraid of reading fiction about things and people that I already knew, because they were American Jews. They probably had figured out how to live. I didn't have the lower upper class Jewish existence that was being written about by, you name it, Philip Roth or Saul Bellow or all these people. How at ease were you in defining, in seeing yourself defined as a Native American writer?
Well, actually, you know, the beginning of reading for me was not with Native writing at all. A lot of the reservation writing, reservation-based or rural-based stuff, it actually made me feel more isolated and less like a Native writer, or like I don't belong there. And so I didn't read a lot. You know, we were talking earlier about South American writers, and you listed the different people that were my favorites. I read a lot of work in translation, and that spoke to me for whatever reason. And so took a very long time to circle back to, you know, aside from John Kennedy Toole and Sylvia Plath, took a long time for me to get back to this country and some of the writers that I know. You know, Dennis Johnson became really big for me.
Yeah.
Because he was writing ugly in a beautiful way.
When I read There by my guest today, Tommy Orange, I was really thrilled to be reading a writing that was not fulfilling people's ethnic desires for more ethnicity in fiction. It seemed to be about good writing, whether ethnic or not. The first criteria, is it good? Is it good? Is it moving? Has it never been seen before? Has it never been said before? Am I giving my people and others as well a sense of a life they don't know? Because what I felt about there was not only was there a there in Oakland, I felt that there was a there in the book. And I hadn't seen a neighborhood in desuetude of the modern sort as well captured as the neighborhood that you catch here in your novel, There.
Thank you. Among the many reasons I love literature is these little moments that you catch where you've only ever maybe thought it, and the author hits on something, and you just feel like you're home or like you belong to something secret that nobody can talk about. And there's just a small moment of belonging and like you're not alone. And when reading does that, especially if it's related to your homeland of any kind or your people or your similar background, doubly so, you feel that same feeling. And I wanted to try to do that with this book and to represent, you know, neighborhoods that we haven't seen or voices we haven't heard. For the reason of trying to replicate in a way, you know, feeling indebted to what literature did for me and to try to do some of the same things to give it back in a way. I mean, that it would be successful, I didn't know, but I knew I wanted to try.
I've been talking with Tommy Orange, author of There, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
It's really nice to know, in addition, that a number of the students who were at IAIA with you are publishing books and that there is a new wave. It's terrific, you know?
There's something really exciting going on.
Yeah.
And I graduated at the same time as Therese Myatt, who wrote Heartberries, which is amazing.
She's a terrific poet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we sold our books within 2 weeks of each other. It was kind of an amazing thing. It's been great to have her, you know, along the way, just touch base with each other, and because we're both going through a kind of insane experience.
Would you tell her to come down and visit us, please?
Yeah, I will.
Please. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Susan Orlean is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.